Now, this is CRKC, Ireland's only radio station with a regular astronomy slot. And we're joined now by David Moore, editor of Astronomy Ireland magazine, to guide us through what's happening in the night sky. And there's plenty to look forward to over the coming days. David, you're very welcome back, as usual, to the programme.
Thanks very much, Eugene.
Now, David, before we look up at the sky itself, you've two big public events coming up, a lecture on galaxies tonight and a Jupiter watch later in the week. Why is this such a good time for people to reconnect with the night sky?
Yeah, well, we'll tell people more about the lecture about galaxies in a moment. But the big thing in the sky that you'll see all week, in fact, all last month and all this month, is Jupiter, which is blazing, quite literally, high overhead for the whole evening. About 10 times brighter than the brightest stars in the sky. So it really is unmistakable. If you don't know anything about constellations, star patterns, you just go out in the clear night and look up after sunset, the big bright star you're going to see, star in quotes, is actually the planet Jupiter. And it's been there for several weeks. It'll be there for another couple of months. It was closest to the Earth back in around the middle of January. But it's a very slow-moving affair. So it'll take it a few months to move out of evening skies. So we've got this big event to point telescopes at it on Friday, this coming Friday, just a few days' time. So we're hoping for clear skies then, and we'll be able to show people the great red spot, the moons of Jupiter, its cloud belts. It's a fantastic planet to see in a telescope.
And this this Jupiter watch is at your headquarters, is it, in just off the M50 there? Am I correct?
That's right, yep. And all the details are on astronomy.ie, yeah, our website, where there's under the contact us section, you'll see there's a map actually, giving you even the air code if you want to navigate in that way. And we're just outside the M50, so you don't need to go into Dublin City, and you'll avoid all the traffic if you want to come along on the Friday evening.
Yeah.
So at least people in the Leinster area should come, if not from further afield.
Yeah.
And, you know, we charge a small fee to look through the telescopes, help run the society. We're a non-profit group, and that helps to subsidize the membership of people throughout the 32 counties.
Of course.
So it's a great event in that regard, and a great event if people actually get to see Jupiter live, because the kind of telescopes we're using are thousands of times more powerful than your eyes, and the views are incredible. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have one of these telescopes, and I've been watching it every clear night for the last few months, and some of the views I've had, the memories will stick with me forever.
And what time does that kick off on Friday?
Yeah, it's on at 7 o'clock. And if you go to astronomy.ie to book your tickets, you'll see the webpage for it. It actually shows simulations of what the planet will look like. And we've chosen Friday night because the great red spot is on the side facing us. Jupiter spins once every 10 hours. Although it's the biggest planet, it's actually the fastest spinning planet. That makes it actually bulge out at the equator, and you'll see a simulation for 7 o'clock, another one for 8 o'clock. You'll be there for at least 1 hour, if not 2 hours, depending on the size of the crowd. And then we've also got a simulation showing which moon is which, and the link, if you've got your own telescope or even a pair of binoculars, that'll help you to identify which moon is which.
Yeah.
That's all on astronomy.ie.
Because I was going to say there, repeat what you were going to say there, just in relation to people who might have got a new telescope, this is another opportunity for them to learn a little bit more about their own telescope, and as you say, to look to powerful telescopes, and up at where it all happens, at astronomy's headquarters in just off the M50 in Dublin. Now, you mentioned that there aren't a huge number of major sky events right now, but one that really stands out is Mercury. Why is this weekend and next week the best evening chance of 2026 to spot it?
Yeah, we've got a new moon coming soon. In fact, there'll be a bit of an eclipse, not visible from Ireland. So that's why the moon isn't in evening skies. And so just Jupiter is dominating the sky. The planet Saturn is there as well, by the way, but it's sort of bowing out low down in the west. And something that's coming up in the west is Mercury. Now, it'll be better next week. The peak time to see it is around the 20th. And you really only get to see Mercury once for 1 week every year. So we're hoping that by this weekend and all of next week, we'll have lots of clear skies and people will be able to see it. It'll be low in the west, so as soon as the sky sun sets and the sky is starting to get dark in the twilight, you want to be looking in the west for a new naked eye star that wasn't there before. That's the planet Mercury. And we'll actually, next week, we'll tell people all about when it's going to line up with the moon, which will really help people to spot it. So it's just to warn people this week that the 1 week window of visibility when Mercury puts on its best show, does it every, usually around March, give or take a month, is coming next week, and to be ready. If you get Astronomy on a magazine, there's already a guide in the magazine to show you how to spot it. And by the way, if you don't get the magazine, as soon as you sign up, you're instantly emailed the diagrams of what to see in the sky, and then the magazine will arrive in the post itself a few days later. So watch out for Mercury, especially next week. We'll give people a better guide next week as well.
Now, David, there's also a lovely close encounter happening before dawn on Wednesday, Antares and the Moon. Can you describe just how close they appear and what kind of visual comparison really excites astronomers?
Yeah, and at this time of year, watching things in the morning, Kai, it's not too bad, because it's around the 7 o'clock mark when a lot of people are up for school or work anyway. And so when you do get up, first thing is to have a look out for the Moon on Wednesday morning. Antares is one of the brightest stars in the sky. It's the brightest star in Scorpius. And it'll be very close to the Moon on Wednesday morning. So close, in fact, that if you held your little finger up at arm's length, you wouldn't be able to get it between the Moon and Antares. That's really close. And so anyone's got a pair of binoculars, use those as well. Get an even closer view. The Moon won't pass in front of Antares for us this time. But just very close. It's about 2 or 3 moon diameters as you're watching in your binoculars away from it. So you look at the Moon low in the east, Wednesday morning around 7, and just above it, there's Antares. You should be able to see it with the naked eye. And in fact, if you view it a little bit early before the twilight gets too strong, the Moon will be a thin crescent. And then you get to see the dark side of the Moon glowing very faintly. It's actually light being reflected off the Earth onto the Moon's dark side. That means you can see the whole disk of the Moon. So that is even more spectacular in binoculars. And most of the things we do in Astronomy on magazines tell people, what can you see with the naked eye? And then maybe a pair of binoculars. A good pair will only cost you around 30 quid these days. So it's a fantastic investment. They should last a lifetime. And they can be about 100 times better than your eyesight. So every house should have one.
And David, just going back to the event on Friday with Jupiter, did you say, or are you giving a talk on Jupiter on that evening as well?
Oh yes, yeah. We always give a talk about the planet itself, just to explain.
Well, give us a few highlights. Give us a few highlights.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's the biggest planet in the solar system, 11 times wider than the Earth, but it's a gas giant, which means it's not made of the same stuff the Earth's made of. We're mostly rock with a metal core, a bit of a thin atmosphere of air going around it. Very important for us humans, but not a significant fraction of the Earth's weight or mass. But on Jupiter, it's gas all the way down. It's not the kind of air we're breathing. It's hydrogen gas, with about a quarter of it being helium. And maybe down at the center, there's a rocky core, but it's not a significant amount compared to the Earth. So a crazy planet, nothing like what we see here. And the hydrogen gas gets squashed in such a crazy way that it ends up turning into something that resembles metal. So it gives Jupiter a deadly radiation field. In fact, when you look at the telescope, because Jupiter is 5 times further from the Sun than we are, it's very cold. The cloud tops look warm and inviting, but if you could actually touch them, they're at minus 130 degrees Celsius. So your fingers would freeze solid. And you could actually snap them off like icicles, except for the fact that if you got close enough to Jupiter to do that, the deadly radiation around Jupiter would kill you in minutes as you were trying to take your gloves off. So a crazy planet with 95 moons, but curiously, 4 of them are big, and the other 91 are tiny. You need a giant telescope, bigger than even the ones we'll have, to see the sort of 5th moon of Jupiter. So there's 4 easy ones to see with binoculars, and then the rest are tiny. Saturn has over 200 moons, but at least they're nicely graded from big ones down to small ones. In Jupiter, no, 4 giant ones, the rest tiny. So an incredible system, well worth looking at in a telescope with its cloud belts, which are caused by the fast rotation of Jupiter and that great red spot a huge swirling storm, a hurricane, the size of the Earth, though, with 500 kilometer per hour winds, much faster than we get on our hurricanes here on the Earth. And it's been blowing for several hundred years. Hurricanes on the Earth only last a few days, a few weeks at best. So we can learn a lot about how planetary atmospheres work on Jupiter, and that's actually been used to refine how the atmosphere on the Earth works to predict our own weather.
Now,
lots of fun on Jupiter.
And that great red spot, it nearly sounds almost mythical, doesn't it? As you say, it's a storm bigger than the Earth, and that's been raging for centuries, is it?
Yeah, and we only had telescopes since Galileo turned the first one on the night sky around the early 1600s. So, 400 years we've had telescopes. Within about 100 years, they were big enough to see the great red spot on Jupiter. And it's been seen since then. So, we've watched it for centuries. Now, over the last few decades, it's actually began to shrink a little bit. And people are wondering, will it finally go away? Or does it just shrink every now and then and come back in with force later on? We'll just have to wait and see. It is a storm, you know, weather systems like very unpredictable, but it would be a shame if it vanished, because even a relatively small amateur telescope can show the great red spot. The telescopes we've got, we can see detail inside the red spot just about, and the surrounding areas. And it's not the only storm on Jupiter. There are big white ovals, which are giant storms the size of the moon or the size, let's say, continental USA, and they are harder to see, but there's multiples of those, and they do come and go over the decades. So it's been a fascinating system. We've actually got one spacecraft orbiting Jupiter at the moment called Juno. People who get the Astronomy Island magazine will have seen pictures a few times a year. They release them of incredible detail that spacecraft can see when it's up close
and
swooping around Jupiter to measure it.
And speaking of Juno, this Juno spacecraft closely monitoring Jupiter, how important are missions like that, David, and how exciting is it still to be getting, as you say, new images and discoveries nearly a decade on?
Yeah, well, for the scientists concerned, it can be a lifetime's work. Missions like Juno take decades to put together, and it's been orbiting Jupiter since 2016, and will keep going for a few more years. So the kind of things that we don't understand about Jupiter, it's not just its atmosphere and what really goes on deep down. Because, you know, we can predict what should happen from how we think the Earth and all the other planets formed out of a huge cloud of gas and dust. And sometimes the results don't match, and then you have to refine your theories to try and better understand not just Jupiter, but the Earth and the rest of the planets as well. And the moons are fascinating because we think there are deep oceans below the icy crust of some of these moons. And they're probably warm. Well, that means the ice in them is very cold out there, has melted, turned to water. And that could allow chemistry, the same chemistry that happened, we think, on the early Earth that led to the first life being formed. So it's possible there is at least simple microbial life swimming around in the oceans of Jupiter. And so measuring those moons as well is extremely important. But there's all that deadly radiation mixed in, which we don't have such a severe case of radiation here on the Earth that we don't know how that will affect the system. So there's a lot to be found out about Jupiter yet.
Now, David, we've been covering what's been going on in the ISS, the International Space Station, when on January the 15th, the SpaceX Crew 11 mission safely returned 4 astronauts to Earth due to a medical evacuation. They returned safely to Earth. I think it's the SpaceX Dragon capsule named Endeavour, splashing down in the Pacific Ocean near San Diego on the 15th of January. Now, there's a mission to launch SpaceX crew back to the International Space Station. Tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, well, the space station is a huge laboratory in space, costing over 100 billion euros. And there are lots of experiments going on board that are worth millions as well. And so normally there'd be a crew of about 6 to 10 people on board. And there's only been 3 since that last crew returned to that medical emergency you mentioned, which NASA won't tell us for privacy reasons exactly who or what was the medical issue. But the important thing is there's only been 3 astronauts, 2 Russians, 1 American, on the space station since. So They've had to reorganize a lot of the workload for those. And the next crew, Crew 12, as it's called, they're going up a little bit earlier than expected to take over and double the manpower that they've got up there. So with a bit of luck, they will launch in the morning, on Thursday morning, at about 10:30 in the morning. So we wish them luck, and they'll very quickly resume the duties of the three things that astronauts do on the space station. They're guinea pigs, because they're watching the effects of weightlessness on their own human bodies. They're lab technicians. They're running the experiments for the scientists back home. And they're caretakers. They have to go out and do spacewalks to fix or add bits to the International Space Station. So it's a fascinating job, full-time job. And we won't see ISS flying over Ireland again in the evening sky until the middle of March. But if all goes well, there'll be a complement of six people on the space station then, instead of the three we've had for the last few weeks.
And, David, coming back with a medical evacuation like that, it's obviously very serious, but very costly, I'd imagine, when they have to return to Earth unexpectedly. I'd imagine it's a costly thing then, returning them, and then going back, as you say, on Thursday morning.
Yeah, the actual, it'd be difficult to measure the actual costs, because it would depend on how many of the experiments were severely interrupted. Has NASA been able to cover all the workload with the existing crew that they have, or did they have to just either cancel particular things, or some results will go unrecorded now, which would be a terrible tragedy for the scientists on the ground, who also will have put their careers, perhaps certainly years, if not decades of work, into getting these experiments on board the space station. So the only good thing about it was that there are procedures for what happens if something goes wrong. Let's suppose it was an accident that happened and somebody needed serious surgery. Then they can rush people back to Earth like they did. This wasn't a big rush in particular, but everything went off exactly as planned and there were no problems. The crew landed safely. So NASA is more, I think, worried about not having any serious manned issues with the personnel on board the space station. Because if you remember back to the shuttle disasters of Challenger and Columbia, the missions were set back for 2 to 3 years at that stage.
And that Challenger
flew from NASA at all.
That Challenger was 40 years only recently, wasn't it? The crash of the Challenger, wasn't that only that 40 years recently, was it?
It was, yeah, that's right. It was 1986. Was it January the 26th or the 28th?
Yeah, something like that.
January.
Yeah. I remember it well. I remember being listened to, being just shocked coming in on the news and the Challenger going. And just in relation, David, to that unfortunate astronaut having to come back to Earth. These are all lessons for NASA as well, how to deal with these, what can do better in the future and all that. They learn from all of these things, don't they? If they're having to return and stuff like that.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is pioneering work. There's only been just over 600 people ever in space since Yuri Gagarin back in 1961. So it's very small numbers. And if you think about it, 7 people lost in Challenger in 86, another 7 lost in Columbia in 2003, there have been other accidents. The Apollo 20 happened on the ground, and some Russian cosmonauts have been lost also. So you're probably talking about a total of around 20 people out of 600. And there aren't many careers you can think of where 1 in 30 people die as a result of it. So space is still a very dangerous occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, NASA and private individuals like Elon Musk's SpaceX and Jeff Bezos' Blue Origins are planning to put, they say, millions of people in space during this century. So you want to have space a lot safer than 1 in 30 fatalities before you reach those kind of numbers. So we're all hoping that everything goes smoothly with these manned missions, but at the end of the day, you just don't know. I have to confess, I keep applying to be an astronaut any chance I get, and you know, the fear of it being dangerous is offset by the incredible experience it would be.
Yeah, well, we wish you luck. I hope sometime you might actually just achieve your goal, David. But finally, tonight's public lecture is all about galaxies. And when you tell people that we live in a star city of nearly one of a trillion stars, and that an Irish scientist helped uncover the role of the black hole at its center, what reaction do you usually get? Tell us about, and tell us about the lecture as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of these talks, galaxy formation, what's that got to do with my everyday life? The answer is, it explains your very existence. And, you know, we're on this rock, the Earth, orbiting a star, the Sun, which is one of nearly a trillion stars, all whooshing around in this big spiral that's 100,000 light years wide, which we now understand quite well. But about 100 years ago, we didn't. We were just beginning to figure out that we were in a galaxy, that there are lots of other galaxies out there in space. And by the way, there's about a trillion galaxies in space, you know, ballpark figures. So there's a trillion stars in the galaxy, a trillion galaxies in the universe that we can see. So there's a trillion stars. And every atom in our body was made in our Milky Way galaxy, except for the hydrogen, and we don't really have much helium inside us. That was made in the Big Bang.
Okay.
But all the big atoms, they were all forged in early stars that went on to make the gas cloud that made the Earth and the planets. And it turns out that Dr. John McGaughrian in 1998 figured out that the giant black hole at the center of our galaxy actually slows up the rate of stars forming in our Milky Way.
Okay.
And that wouldn't have happened as slowly as it has. And life wouldn't have had, intelligent life, wouldn't have had a chance to evolve. So we owe our existence to the black hole in the middle of our galaxy. Who would have thought that? And it's great that an Irishman was the one that figured that out. And all these kind of things, for the general public, would be explained at the talk.
Okay. 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock. Yeah. Okay. So that, look, we leave it there. And Kevin just typed in, and none of it possible without CO2. Kevin texted in there too as well. David Moore, editor of Astronomy Ireland magazine. Thank you as always for joining me on the program. And if people want to buy tickets or look at anything that's going on, go to astronomy.ie. And as David says, you're all very welcome. That brings us to the end of Stephen's.